Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Kimberly Saavedra, director of the Comlock Center in California. Dr. Betty Kovach, author of The Miracle of Death and her forthcoming publication, The Merchants of Light, and I have the pleasure of co-hosting today's show. Before we introduce our guest, we thank the sponsor of today's show, the Windbridge Institute, which is an independent research organization investigating the capabilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn about their research projects and findings. Also, Forever Family Foundation's 6th Annual Grief Transformation Retreat will take place in Chester, Connecticut on Friday, July 14th to Sunday, July 16th. We know firsthand that the setting is beautiful, the people are wonderful, and something magical always happens. For more information, please visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org today.
Okay. Well, today we're very pleased that we have Dr. Joseph M. Veltzer with us to talk about his work. Dr. Veltzer graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Boston University and received his doctorate in philosophy from the University of Chicago. And he has taught for many years at Kingsborough Community College in Brooklyn, New York. He's the author of two books, The Way Back to Paradise, Restoring the Balance Between Magic and Reason, and The Myth of the Great Ending, Why We've Been Longing for the End of Days Since the Beginning of Time. And we will be talking with Dr. Veltzer about these books, as well as his work in the Monroe Institute, which I'll mention in just a moment. But first of all, he's written so many articles published in both scholarly and popular journals that I couldn't even begin to mention them. But just rest assured that he is a scholar, the First Order, and has done much work in religion, spirituality, parapsychology, myth. So today, it's really a special treat to be able to talk with him about all of these subjects as he has reflected them in his books. Also, as I mentioned earlier, he has worked with the Monroe Institute since 2000. He participated in the Gateway Voyage Program, and he talks about that in his book, The Way Back to Paradise. And he really has some very exciting and meaningful experiences, I think, to tell us about that. But he has been professionally related to the Institute since 2006 as a guest, member, and researcher. So welcome, Dr. Veltzer. Are you still there?
And your introduction. Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Yes. I think a good way to begin is for you to tell us what paradise is and what magic is. If we're to find our way back to it, what is it?
Well, I think it's our natural state of being. I think in the book I use magic as kind of a shorthand for, I guess, what Stan Grof, the Czech psychiatric researcher, would call non-ordinary states of consciousness. And I mm-hmm. think that those are completely natural to us. And I think that we in the West have a special case in the sense that we have divested from that natural state. And I think there's a whole historical reason behind that. And as Stan Grof and Michael Harner say, the Western, from a cross-cultural perspective, our Western approach to the psyche, to the human soul, is both ethnocentric and cognoscentric. Ethnocentric in the sense that we say that only Western science, understood in a very kind of materialistic way, has access to truth and knowledge, and cognoscentric in the sense that only observations and experiences undertaken in waking ordinary states of ego consciousness have validity. And you don't find that in other cultures. And so, you know, the question is, why did this happen, and how can we undo it, not only from a cultural standpoint, but also as individuals, you know, what can we do to bring ourselves closer to a more harmonious and balanced life? So that's, you know, that was the theme that I undertook in that first book. And
So really, what we have called super normal or supernatural or parapsychology, really, you're just saying that's perfectly normal once we're awakened to the universe around us.
And then, right. I think it's, you know, it's para and super only because we have such an attenuated view of what nature is.
Yeah.
So I think that ultimately, and I think this is happening now, I think, you know, science is not where it was 200 years ago, 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago. And I think that there is a wider discussion of consciousness and more openness. You know, one of the remarks that's been made is a generation of scientists has to die out before, you know, real change is made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some truth to that. But I also think that, you know, things are changing within science itself. But I think that if you look at the history, and this is something I went into a little bit in the second book, I think there are really four things that have influenced the, you know, the split between, you know, magic and reason. You know, I think the first thing that happened about 8,000 years ago is the agricultural revolution itself, because I think that the beginning of our kind of war on nature, where we want to control and dominate nature,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the kind of outlook that you get in most indigenous cultures that I'm aware of, that do value non-ordinary states of consciousness and do experience these things all the time and don't regard them as para or supernormal. But when you have this attitude of we're going to control nature and put it to our service, as we, you know, Western thinking got informed by this idea, I think that starts changing things with respect to human nature as well. So I think that was the start. I think
mm-hmm.
another key episode or series of episodes or events had to do with the development of Greek philosophy in the 4th century in ancient Greece, and particularly in Athens, where figures such as Socrates and Plato emphasized rationality, and rightly so. In fact, they went so far as to say that the soul, the essence of the human being, is our rationality, and this is what survives the death of the body. Now, Socrates and Plato were also mystics. The thing is that undoubtedly they partook of the great mysteries, the Eleusinian mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
They knew from their own experience that we're more than our physical body. Socrates had his spirit guide, his daimon. Socrates went into trances and was inspired that way. Plato wrote his philosophy in the form of stories. And what happens after that, I think especially with Plato's student Aristotle, is that you get an emphasis exclusively on rationality to the,
yes.
the exclusion of the mystical element. So I think that was a second major development, because it was back to the Greeks that our scientific revolution looked in the 16th and 17th century. And I think it was that overly rationalistic Aristotelian view that came to dominate, especially Aristotle went out. His great student was Alexander the Great. And so when Alexander did his conquering, he took Aristotle with him. And so this becomes the sort of gold standard of Greek philosophy. And then I think the third major development in the West that gives us this problem is Christianity, the form of Christianity that was adopted as the official religion of the Roman Empire, was really only one version of it. Now, the Gnostic versions of it all emphasized the importance of the inner experience of the divine. And the one that got adopted was what you might call St. Paul's version of it, which, I mean, Paul had this great experience himself on the road to Damascus, the conversion experience, but to export Christianity, he made belief, in other words, the you know, intellectual assent to certain propositions as the essence of the religion, as the gateway to salvation. And then the church comes along, and the priests of the church are not themselves necessarily mystics, but their authority derives from their social ordination, and their power derives from that, and not necessarily, like the shamans, from an inner experience. So we have an emphasis on ritual and an emphasis on belief, and the inner experiences get cut out, to the extent to which later on, in fact, one of the edicts of the church says that you shouldn't interpret your own dreams. That becomes anathema.
I know, it's incredible.
Yeah, and then of course in the 16th and 17th century, the scientific revolution. Now, you know, people like Newton, they were spiritual people, but the religious Newton believed that there was a cosmic intelligence and so forth. But the scientists that followed him and sort of did away with that dimension. You know, Laplace's famous remark, I have no need of that hypothesis. So what you get in terms of the view of the universe that comes out of that is that the world is a kind of machine that operates according to certain deterministic laws of nature, that only physical matter is ultimately real, and that only the scientific method gives us adequate knowledge of physical matter and its operations. So
yeah.
This is, I think, you know, the four building blocks of mm-hmm. of this view that comes to dominate and that comes to dismiss. And the irony of that is that René Descartes, who was also an early scientist and the founder of modern philosophy, the person actually who created, in a sense, the scientific method, got his main ideas from three dreams that he had. And so...
That's often the case, isn't it, that you hear scientists...
Yes, but there was no room in a philosophy that was created for this kind of non-rational experience and inspiration. And so we have an exclusive kind of emphasis on rationality and a kind of dogmatic belief that ultimately everything has to be reduced to discussion of physical matter understood as something that is inherently mechanical. And
I can't imagine that there has ever been a worldview that has been more damaging than the worldview that there's nothing but matter and that we as individuals cannot affect matter and we have no purpose or meaning. We're a fluke. That has so wounded, I think, Western consciousness. And you've laid out very well, I think, major causes for us coming up with such a worldview. You know, the other day we interviewed someone who had herself interviewed many scientists. And when I was going through the manuscript, I was so pleased to see that Amit Goswami, a scientist who's worked in chaos theory and so on, and he said, which was so amazing, he said, Every one of us has a purpose, and science has a purpose. And the purpose today of science is to help us to discover soul.
Yes.
I thought I would never hear a scientist say that.
Well, I think it's becoming inescapable. You know, when you look at physics and biology, and I mean, even in, for example, the study of animal. I mean, Descartes himself did not believe that animals had consciousness or soul.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't understand that. But but now you have, you know, more and more scientists themselves who are studying animals and so forth coming to the acceptance that animals not only have feelings, but they have consciousness and memory and... you know, that they're real beings. And this is, of course, what the ancients believed, you know, that
exactly.
Everything has soul. And, you know, the physics is telling us that the ultimate building block of matter is not a tiny particle, but consciousness. So I think that...
Yes, there's certainly... Now with quantum physics, I mean, many of those scientists are saying that, of course, consciousness is. It is primary, and it creates the universe. So that being true, then... we would all have to have consciousness. Everything in the universe would be conscious. And I know that you were very interested in Native Americans and shamans, which you talk about in your books. And certainly they have experiences with animals. And in the early years, it was thought that early stages of our development, that animals probably had more consciousness than we did, and they went to them for experiences. Yeah. So, yeah. But I liked so much when you said that it's a sacred duty for all of us to take this journey to reintegrate magic into our lives, to you put it, I think, this way, to heal our brokenness and awaken to our innate sensitivity to this magic, which would be meaning and inspiration. And then you say, this is necessary if we are to survive as a species on this planet. I agree with you. Is there anything more you want to say about that?
Well, I think that is our task, to expand our awareness and expand the consciousness. And I think our survival does depend on it. And you look around today, and you see a lot of pulling back, and a lot of fear, and I think that, you know, history does move in cycles. There is expansion, and then there is contraction, and I think we're seeing a major fear moment right now, and there's a lot of contraction, and you can see the danger involved in that. You know, Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychiatrist, once said, you know, the great danger is the psyche. You know, it's the psyche that has access to and creates the bombs and so forth. So if the psyche is unbalanced, then we do have tremendous power. You know, Francis Bacon said knowledge is power, and we do have, thanks to our technology, we do have tremendous power, and it's dangerous. And I think that when we feel disconnected from each other, when we feel disconnected from the world, and disconnected from ourselves, I think we put ourselves at grave peril. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So I would say that it's critical, yeah.
Dr. Felser, that's funny. You mentioned the Jung quote. That was one that jumped out at me loudly and clearly in The Myth of the Great Ending. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read it. I thought it was beautifully said. There is no such thing in nature as an H-bomb. That is all man's doing. We are the great danger. The psyche is the great danger.
Yes.
That's so good.
We get credit for all that.
Yes. And you in the other book, in The Way Back to Paradise, had mentioned Jung's statement about trust. And I would like you to talk about that in a minute, too, that if you don't trust yourself, you have to expect a neurosis. And I suppose that's what we're viewing, you know, pretty collectively.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that mistrust goes back to, you know, this notion that nature is something to fear, or that nature is somehow evil, and we've got to get a hold of it before it gets us, and put it to our purposes. That our purpose is to harness nature's secrets and put them to our service, and whereas the old way of thinking about it was that we're part of a community of life, and our purpose is to serve that community, to serve life, and to find our place in the universe. We do have purpose, and it's being connected to the whole, and we are connected to the whole. It's just that we forget.
It's experience, like, yes.
Yeah, and so we concentrate on our separateness to the exclusion of the connectedness, and so we need to deprogram ourselves in a way. I mean, that's the way I start to think about it some years ago, that it's not so much something that we have to do, but something that we have to undo.
Yes.
And it's kind of like we're locked in this trance of feeling separate, and when you feel separate, then fear comes on the scene, and then when fear comes on the scene, then anger and hatred, you know. So it's kind of like a domino effect. And so the primary thing is to get back to this illusion of separateness, and to somehow sink into the experiences in which that doesn't happen. And
yes, I like that, to sink into the experiences. I thought your book was very good in showing in detail through your own life how, by paying attention, giving your attention to the dreams over a period of many years, that you could begin to see the synchronicities and of how the language of spirit or nature works. That and that might be very good to talk about. I was very impressed with the rabbit dreams, and that kind of is a wonderful icon of so much of what happens in the book. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I had this very powerful dream at a particularly difficult point in my life, and I didn't really know what direction I should take, if I should continue with my academic work, and it wasn't going well. And I had this dream in which I was confronted by a talking rabbit. I wasn't confronted so much, but I looked out the back door of my house, and I saw this rabbit, this creature, and it was communicating with me in a telepathic kind of way, as it often happens in dreams. And what it said to me is that I fell asleep under the tree, and it was I felt very sad when it said that. And at the same time, I was standing near the sink in the kitchen, and there were three baby rabbits in the sink, and it reminded me almost like a womb. And so it was like something was coming to birth, and something was very sad. And it was through that dream, I think, and working out its meaning and following the path of that, you know, like Alice and the rabbit hole in a way. But that really started me off on a path of paying a lot of attention to my dreams. And also it was around the time that I actually discovered Carl Jung and his work and archetypal psychology and so forth. So it opened me up in a lot of ways. And I had always been paying attention to my dreams. I'd had very powerful dreams since I was a child, and that one in particular was something that really grabbed my attention. And I knew that something in me had fallen asleep, that like Rip Van Winkle had gone to sleep and was now waking up, and I needed to follow that. And, at the time, it sort of struck me as very strange, but then the more I read and the more I thought about it and the more I followed it, it did really open things up for me in a big way.
Well, yes, and there were so many experiences throughout, at least 20 years, I remember, of your life in which the rabbit or the color white would come up, and you would see its relationship. It's like putting a piece of the puzzle in each time it recurred, and you could see the larger meaning. And it seems interesting because we get another piece of the puzzle, it seems, at the time that we're able to understand it or that we've developed to that point. But I thought all of the discussion about the rabbits, and even 20 years later when a student who was very shamanic in his experiences brought you a calendar from Japan.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it was the year of the rabbit on there, yes. And Kaito, he was the one that said, oh, we're all shamans. And I mean, it did follow through. And it also, that series of coincidences led me to meet Rhea White,
yeah,
who became a very important person in my my professional career, really, because by accident I sort of read an article that she had written for a magazine and got in touch with her. This is before email, and I actually sat down and wrote a physical letter, and she finally responded to me, and it was through that correspondence, really. She had originally worked with Joseph Banks Rhine, the father of modern parapsychology, you know, down at Duke. Mm-hmm. She was a lab assistant of his, and then she went on to become very involved in parapsychology and edited the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research, and went on to found her own journal, Exceptional Human Experience. I was editorial advisor for that for a number of years. And so it was really through her that I started writing articles for professional parapsychology journals, and she had encouraged me to do that and introduced me to other people in the field, including a fellow by the name of Steve Rosen, who was at the College of Staten Island then, and he was a psychologist, a philosopher. In fact, he had done work with the great physicist in England, David Bohm. And so it really just following that trail really opened me up. And not only that, I realized only today, actually, when I was thinking about this, that it was through my connection with Rhea that I met a researcher by the name of Suzanne Brown. And it was Suzanne who knew someone at the Monroe Institute.
and
it was through that, it was through that connection that I got connected with the Monroe Institute. So it really is like a puzzle. Yes,
you say everything is secretly linked together by invisible bonds, and you certainly have many experiences of that.
Yeah. And you're right. It does unfold in its own time, and it can't be rushed. And I think that's the importance, because Rhea, one of the things that Rhea was very, very keen on was this idea of writing one's own exceptional human experience autobiography. And she's actually the one that coined that term, by the way, EHE, exceptional human experience.
Oh, I got that. I had to look that up. What is that? And then I saw that it was she who had coined the term.
Yes. And she emphasized just this, that once you start looking at these experiences, not in isolation as an event in the past, but mm-hmm. as something that is still unfolding in the present, that all of these connections start to pop up and you see the pattern, and that's why it's
the
important
pattern,
to write
yes.
these things down and to pay attention to them, you know?
Yeah, that's really important, I think, is that we think, well, what in the world did that mean? That was strange. But your point is to hold on to it and nurture the images, and that as we do that, we will begin to see a pattern emerge.
Yes. I mean, you don't necessarily know the meaning right off. But I think that, yes, the pattern, there is a pattern, and it does unfold. And that's why I think, you know, you mentioned before the importance of trust.
Yes.
You know, being patient and allowing it to unfold in its own time. That's the way that nature works, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that is a lesson that in our kind of rushed and crazy world that we really do need to learn is that's learning how to be a partner with nature, to know that it will unfold in its own time, because very often we just don't understand it. But if we hold on to it, keep it in consciousness, then we will begin to get the other pieces. I wanted to say, too, that I was impressed with the fact that you do point out that the rabbit was under the cosmic tree, that cosmic tree that has always given us the fruit of who we really are.
Yes.
And when the rabbit said, I fell asleep under the tree,
yes.
I was very moved by that. And later, when those rabbits come back in the calendar, they are adult, fully grown rabbits, aren't they?
Yes. That was, I think, a very interesting point in the process. And that was around the time that I did go to Monroe for the first time and went through a program there. And so I think something was, you know, coming to fruition at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important to be patient. And
yes, over many years sometimes.
In fact, Rhea did call these things, she called them seeds. And, you know, they need cultivation,
seeds.
They need nurturing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's beautiful, yes.
Light and water and, attention, conscious attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because sometimes when we have the seed planted in the soil of our psyche, we probably couldn't understand it until time has passed and something in us has grown, both unconsciously and consciously. I was also interested in what you called metaphysical malnutrition. And that is an incredibly wonderful way of putting it. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's where we are in a way. I mean, I think that
absolutely.
The more fascinated we've become by our machines, the more mechanical, in a sense, we've become. It's just an effect of the where we are at this point in our development, And I think that's the real danger, is that the machine not only becomes the paradigm of reality, but it affects our relationship with ourselves, with each other. Can we unplug from the machines? Can we, can we get back to the silence? Can we do without the constant stimulus of the phones and the texting and the we have the machine 24/7 now, and it's inescapable, and there's no use fighting it because it's here and it's not going anywhere. But the question is, can we not lose our the humanity in the process, and the sense of, again, this is a mechanical connection, but there are other kinds of connections. And I think that,
yes, and you talked about food as being that your experience with using food to try to fill up that missingness, that empty space, that malnutrition. Do you want to talk about that? I thought Hamburger Boy was a very interesting experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I did go through this period when I was younger, where I had a weight problem, and it was I just would sit down and eat like boxes of cookies and things like this, and
everybody can relate to that, probably.
Yeah, and it was I guess it was a way of anesthetizing something, and so one day I was with my father. We used to go to a luncheonette on Sunday, and he would pick up the Sunday paper, and I would get comic books. I love to read comic books, and I'm walking out of the luncheonette, and all of a sudden I just notice over on the side that there's someone sitting at the lunch counter, and he looked up at me the same time that I looked over at him, and it was as if I was staring into a mirror. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. It was just he was me. I was him, and I think that he had must have had the same look on his face that I had, that I felt like I had on mine. And I walked out, and it was I just felt very, I was just astonished. I mean, I did not have this term for many years, but many years later I thought, well, that was my doppelganger, because at the time I was overweight, but I wasn't that overweight, but that's the person that I would grow into.
And you would
and so it took me years to really to assimilate that and to to understand what was going on and to get out of that rut.
But it certainly made the impression on you. Well, when I was a kid in grade school, I guess I kept thinking I need water, and I drink water, and water wouldn't help me. And I finally just decided, well, I guess that's just the way life is. There are those things that you can't help with drinking water. And so when you were talking about eating, I mean, I lived with that for such a long time, and it was definitely that metaphysical malnutrition, which, of course, I would have known nothing about at the time. But you mentioned one other doppelganger, the young woman who seemed to meet her future self.
Yeah,
could you tell that story? Because that was very similar to your experience.
Yeah, I remember now. She was a student of mine. I believe it was when I was teaching at Staten Island, and she talked about she also had a weight problem, and she had, I believe, a dream in which this sort of like almost like a fairy godmother presence came to her and, instructed her about, the proper ways of eating, and that you should take care of your body, and that this is very important to be conscious of this and not to use food as a kind of anesthetic and so forth. And she was describing the qualities of this person that was in her dream, she was an older student at the time. I mean, she had been out of school for a very long time. I forget what her story was, but she was coming back to school, and so she was telling me the story, and as she was telling this story to me, I just looked at her, and I knew that was
her.
Her future self had come to instruct her, and I think she felt that way too. That was her way of helping herself, and so that's interesting, because that happened to Robert Monroe as well. So I think this is a common, more common than people might think, that the sense of coming back. I know there are some people who believe that UFOs are not from another planet, but from our own future. I this is an interesting hypothesis. It sort of fits in with that view that time is very plastic.
Yes.
And these things sort of, these bleed-throughs, and that these loops happen all the time. So I thought that was very interesting.
Well, it seems that nature or consciousness has so many ways of communicating with us, and the doppelganger is certainly one way. Kim was just thinking about Monroe, too, and then you mentioned it. But the Jane Roberts and her husband at the bar, that was a very impressive experience with a doppelganger.
Yeah, yes. I mean, that's how the Seth material got started. I remember reading that in the book, and I thought that was a very similar kind of experience. You know, it was a possible future that they could have taken but didn't, and it sort of, you know, shocked them out of their lethargy at the moment. And
yes, tell our listeners what that was, what their experience was.
Jane and Rob were at the time, I guess this was before the Seth material started. They, early 60s, they were in York Beach, Maine, and I guess Rob had been having back trouble, and Jane was discouraged about her writing, and they went to this, they were in a hotel, in a hotel bar, and I guess a band was playing, and they saw across the way this kind of embittered older couple kind of just sitting there, and they both saw these two people, and all of a sudden Rob got up, told Jane, look, we got to dance. And, you know, here his back had been killing him and everything. And they got up and they started dancing. And, it, you know, Jane wrote about this later on, and she called them, I think, the York Beach Fragments, and how it was some version of them in a future in which they didn't pursue their inner work, their dreams, as it were, and just allowed themselves to become, you know, an old embittered couple who had soured on life, and hadn't followed what I guess Joseph Campbell would refer to as the call, you know, the call to adventure, and so this was in retrospect, it was a very important part, because that it was shortly after that. Jane started having these intense psychic experiences, and the whole Seth phenomenon started.
You know, you emphasize in your book, and I think it's such an important emphasis, is we've been in our culture, we've sort of reduced our sense of who we are and the power of the psyche. And when you say that if we don't answer our own inner call, we'll probably just allow something to be destroyed. I love the quotation from the Jesus of the Nag Hammadi text, and you had it in your book too, is that if we bring forth what is within us, that will save us. But if we do not bring forth what is within us, it will destroy us.
Yes.
And I think it's so hard for everybody to realize that each of us has a calling, a sacred calling, of something sacred to bring forth. And we don't all have the doppelganger experience. That's a wonderful way to wake us up. But there, we are communicated with on one level or another, whether it's through dreams or outer events or whatever, if we just can be awake enough to pick it up. And I think you make a very good point of that. But let's go to the Monroe Institute. That was some very profound work. And certainly that experience reflects the power of the individual and the expansiveness of the individual. Could you talk about your experiences there?
Well, that's a tall order.
I know,
but
it's
yeah.
Pretty complex.
That, I started using the I had read Bon Bon Ro's books, I guess, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I knew that there was a Monroe Institute when I read his second book, Far Journeys. I'd been very impressed by the first book because it seemed to me that he was both, you know, not only had deep experiences, but was also very careful and very scrupulous about reporting them and did not sensationalize things and was really honestly trying to come
too.
To grips with what was happening. And then I learned that he had this institute down in Virginia. I didn't actually get there until the year 2000 when I had a small grant for research and that's when I contacted actually the person who's now the head of the Monroe Institute, Nancy, we all call her Scooter McMonagle, who is Bob Monroe's stepdaughter. And at the time, she was not on the staff of the Institute, although she had run it before and back in the late 70s and early 80s, I believe. But I met Scooter and her husband, Joe, and they introduced me to the Institute, and I took a program there, the Gateway, and that was in the year 2000, and that really blew me away. It was just a tremendous experience for me, and I think that there were two things that happened. One was an experience I had in one of the sessions. Monroe uses audio technology to essentially put you into deep states of meditation. And one of the experiences that I had was of what I called Olympian laughter. And I remember being in my check unit, which is kind of like a small Pullman berth. It's been likened to almost like a sensory deprivation box. And I was in this non-ordinary state, and I heard this echoing laughter that reminded me of the gods laughing. And I didn't feel as though they were laughing at us. I felt that it was the universe laughing. And it reminded me of a feeling that I'd had since childhood, really. I guess you would call it an intimation of unseen things. There was just a sense that the universe was essentially a friendly place, and reality was not something to be afraid of. And the connection with that and the last experience that I had in the program was, it's hard to describe, but I would say it was a feeling of just being connected with everything. It was just a joyous feeling of being connected with everything. And it just was really indescribable. It was kind of mystical. And I thought, well, this is my personal experience. And I felt like I was walking on air. I'd never experienced anything quite so marvelous and joyous. Mm-hmm. And as I walked down to the cafeteria, because I think we went right to dinner that night, there was a woman in the program who had come with her husband, Patricia and Sam. I'll never forget them. And I looked over at Patricia, and she looked at me, and we just both burst out laughing. And it was the kind of validation that often happens at these programs, because often people share experiences, and it was wordless. Neither of us exchanged a word, but we both knew that we had been in the same place. And we had both experienced what we had experienced, and it was absolutely amazing. So that really sent me back a number of times to a number of programs, and I've been affiliated with the Institute ever since. I've been a member of the professional division. I gave a keynote speech there a number of years ago at the professional meeting, and last year, in December 2015, I was honored and pleased to be elected to the board of directors. So this past year or so, I've been helping to, giving my input in terms of, helping the place to evolve as it is evolving. And Scooter's done a marvelous job as a director, and all kinds of new things and new innovations and programs and new research director, new staff, just amazing things are happening there. So I'm really pleased to be a part of it.
Oh, yes.
That's amazing, Dr. Hoover.
Yeah.
And I imagine a lot of the people who attend those programs are particularly interested in survival of consciousness and maybe getting in touch, or at least knowing the loved ones that they are longing for still exists somewhere. Can you speak in terms of what you have come to know about life after the physical death?
Well, I think that's,
experience
yeah.
To that?
I mean, of course, if consciousness is not limited to the physical body, when we're alive, it goes without saying that when the physical body is no longer there, that consciousness is still there. You know, the physical body, the brain, is the what William James called the transducer of consciousness. It doesn't produce it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the TV doesn't produce the show, it simply presents it to our senses, and when the TV's gone, the show's still there. So,
that's a good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as far as my own experiences go, I mean, absolutely, I have no doubt that there is survival of consciousness beyond the physical. I'll give you one story. Many years ago, back in the 1970s, there was a folk singer named Cat Stevens. Do you remember Cat Stevens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was a favorite of mine, and one day I was talking with my cousin Richard, who I was very close to. We were 4 years apart, but he was older, and I guess he was in high school at the time, or no, he was in college at the time, and I was in high school, and we discovered that we both loved Cat Stevens, and he told me about this particular Cat Stevens album that I didn't have, and I looked for it, and I couldn't find it, and then not long after that, I went off to college myself a couple of years after, and I was in Boston, and I found the album that he was telling me about, and then there was a particular song on that album that that really became my favorite song, and the song was I Think I See the Light. And one of the lines was, I think I see the light coming to me, coming through me, giving me a second sight. And fast forward, by the 1990s, no one was playing Cat Stevens anymore because he had converted to Islam, become Yusuf Islam, and was involved in that whole Salman Rushdie thing. And well, anyway, my cousin died very young. He was 39 years old when he died. And so it was very tragic, and we had been very close as kids. In fact, when people saw us together, they often thought that we were brothers, and because we looked somewhat alike. And I've been close to him, and it was very difficult for me. And I was driving home from the funeral, and all of a sudden I got the impulse to turn the radio on. I turned the radio on, and what do I hear? What song do I hear? But someone playing Cat Stevens, I Think I See the Light, and it was almost like, it just blew me away, because I knew that, you know, that song I had associated with him because of that whole sequence.
That's beautiful.
And
yeah.
It was like he was saying that he was okay.
Yes.
And so that, you know, it's a kind of synchronistic thing, but, you know, no one was playing Cat Stevens music at the time. I mean, it was very... Yeah, and that particular song. So...
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing, and you know, dreams. I have dreams of, you know, people that have passed on, and there's no question in my mind that it's really them.
Yes.
The morning of my mother's funeral, my future wife and my future sister-in-law and I were standing in my in the upstairs in the house where my parents' house in my old bedroom. And we were standing there, and all of a sudden we're looking at each other. And I said, "Do you smell that?" And my future wife said, "Yes." And my future sister-in-law said, "Yes." And what we smelled was cigarette smoke. And not stale cigarette smoke, but as if someone was standing there lighting a cigarette, smoking a cigarette. My mother was a smoker. So I think that was her way of saying that she was okay.
Okay. Well, certainly life is magic.
Yes,
all of these experiences are reflections of that magic, and we really thank you. I think now it's just about our time, isn't it, Kim?
Dr. Felcher, would you like to let us know what you're working on, and also provide your website for our listeners so they can follow up with you after the show?
Yeah, sure, I'd be delighted to. Well, the website is www.everythingtriestoberound.com. It's rather long, but that was a statement of Black Elk. Everything tries to be round, and there's an email that you can connect with there, and some of my articles, and also links, I believe, to the Monroe Institute and other places. And as far as what I'm working on right now, I'm working on a couple of things. I'm working on a new book, and I just started work on it, and it has to do with sort of following your bliss in middle age. So
sounds good.
Yeah, many people interested in that.
Yes, and so I have that at another project that I'm working on with a couple of people that I met through the Monroe Institute. In fact, a fellow by the name of Cam Danielson and another by the name of Nick Ross. And I know so many wonderful people through my association with Monroe, both staff and just participants and other researchers that I've met. And we're working on the development of a workshop, and so there's things are happening, and I'm excited. So I look forward, and my work on the board of directors of the Monroe Institute, and that is very, very gratifying. So.
Well, as you said in the book, that you're passing it on.
you're going to teach what
you've learned, huh?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much, Dr. Feld, for talking with us today and sharing so much about the work you've done through the decades.
It was a delight to talk to you. Very, very much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Very honest, direct work. I loved it.
Thank you.
And
thank you very much.
Message to our listeners, remember to visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org to find out more about the Grief Transformation Retreat in July. And thank you all for listening today.